Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Okay, here in this study guide, then, basically it works on the principles that the students have already read this chapter, and then you're going to go through the chapter, you know, to some degree to get the main points to make sure everybody understood. Then after having read it, and then, you know, along with this, and then discussing it, then after that, then there's the essay question at the end of the chapter. So then, that being handed in, then who's running the course, the teacher, then can understand if you absorb the material or not. Right? Whole idea is that in the study is that we should understand, we should get the, how you say, that depth that is there in the understanding. Does this make sense? It means memorization is only a preliminary stage in the Vedic education. It's not considered education. Of course, it's part of education, but itself, it's not education. Education means actually absorbing the topic, being able to understand it, being able to apply it. Right? Does that make sense? Right? Yes? No?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay, so now here is based around the questions and answers. That's where the main focus is, though all the other, everything else is then connected to that. It means you need to have some form for the study, right? There must be some element. So the chronological reading of the matter, that has been done, right? It means that's what you're going through. But then in the study here is we're taking the form of the questions. Does this make sense? Because a conversation means question and answer. So the natural form of this study then is the question and answers as asked by Purukhit Maharaj and then answered by Sukadeva Goswami. Or, you know, Shanaka Rishi and Suta Goswami. But in any case, a question has been answered. That's why it's there. Like these sages, I mean, the sages ask six questions to Suta Goswami, to understand actually what is the ultimate purpose, you know, of the Vedas, what's the ultimate teaching to be gained, what is the most important thing that one can learn, you know, from the study of the Vedas. So then that's answered by pointing out that devotional service to the Supreme Lord, that's the topmost, and that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Krishna is there in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam for the Kali Yuga, right? So that takes up your first three chapters of the first canto. Then they understand that then this Bhagavatam then was spoken by Purukhit to Sukadeva. Sukadeva to Purukhit. So then, what's the history behind it? Why did it come up? Why was it spoken? Right? How did it come that they met? You know, so in other words, the history of that. So then that starts. Then Then it starts the element that Vyasadeva is going to write the Bhagavatam, because in writing the Mahabharata, which was the conclusion of all the Vedic literatures, that it didn't actually do the job. Does that make sense? It means that all the Vedic literatures are written, and so that you would understand what was the essential points and what was the most important rules out of everything, then that was given. But in doing that, then people might misunderstand actually what the essence was. They would get very nicely the practice of the culture. As we see in India, then the culture is still to this day being practiced based on the Mahabharata. But the actual point that was there is the culture is the practice of someone who has a value. Does that make sense? Right? It means that you have a philosophy. Right? That philosophy then generates certain values. That values then generates a lifestyle. Does that make sense? So the culture and the philosophy are not divorced from each other. They're actually connected. You can't have one without the other. Right? There's no use to philosophy if you don't have the religion to establish, you know, to express it through. The religion has no meaning if there's no specific, how you say, direction or goal or purpose to living the culture, right? So in there, the culture got through, but the actual philosophy that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and that we're supposed to serve Him, that may have been missed, right? Because let us say we have so many rules, like we discussed the other day on the Dharma Shastra. So then people read the rules and they go, oh, so many rules. You know, how can anyone follow that? Oh, that can't be followed in Kali Yuga, this, that, blah, blah, blah. So then the whole point is that in that form, only a few people can actually appreciate something. You give them the list of rules, they read the rules, they understand what's the essential point of the rules, what connects all the rules together, so that's actually your point. Rules are a medium for this, right? As we may have discussed, I'm not sure, is that if you're going to have a relationship, there must be some medium through which you can express the relationship, right? Does that make sense? Means that you have one, it has no real seeming meaning unless it's expressed. Right, you can be attracted to interact with the person, you can be attached to interacting with the person, but if you don't interact, how is that attachment or desire expressed? Does that make sense? Right? How it can't be expressed. Therefore, there must be some form of expression. So now, it's either that we're going to follow that which is handed down to us from the Lord, or we're going to create our own, right? Like you have a group of people and they like motorcycles, right? So they get together. Now they're going to have their own greetings, their own handshake, their own rules for interacting, their own dress, their own vocabulary, their own diet, their own activities that makes them a group of motorcycle people. Does that make sense? And if you don't follow that, then they think you're strange. And if you really don't want to follow it, they throw you out of the group. Does that make sense? So there's some medium through which you express the common relationship. Does that make sense? So that's what form is for. Form is to express one's relationship. Right? Does that make sense? Like we dress the way we dress because of our relationship with Krishna and the devotees. We eat what we eat because of that. We speak the language the same way. Does that make sense? Right? It expresses that. Someone sees, you know, someone out wearing the mother's, you know, how you say, orange bed sheets. Right? Then everybody knows, oh, it's Hare Krishna's. Right? They chant Hare Krishna, they worship Krishna. You understand? So it's a medium. Right? So like that, language is a medium, so much other aspects of the etiquette are a medium. Right? So something has to be there as the medium. So, therefore, then, the culture is there as a medium, but a medium of what? Of expressing our relationship with Krishna. So the Mahabharata gets the medium across very well, but the point that it's to please Krishna, that may or may not have been understood, right? It's there, it's written there, so the devotees, when they read it, of course, that's what they gain from it. But those who are not necessarily devotees or established well on the devotional path may miss the point altogether, right? Does that make sense? Like that. So you have hundreds of millions of persons in India who appreciate the Mahabharata who missed the point. But they follow the culture. So then Narad Muni points that out is that they miss the point, they don't understand Krishna's Supreme Person. And not only that, is that you give so many rules and all, that was the point that we were making, is that if we give just rules, very few will catch it. So you put it in the form of stories, then they will appreciate the culture. Right? They'll appreciate your rule. Right? You nicely weave it into the story. So all that in Mahabharata, those are real stories. So what he's done is out of all so many unlimited stories in the universe, he's pulled those ones who are going to express all those points, right? And put them together very expertly. So that's why he's considered Vyasa as the greatest writer. So now, but in doing that, then people are inspired because of the story to read it, and from reading the story, then they learn so much, right? But the tendency might be that they're reading the story because the story is interesting, not because the material that's being presented in the story is of importance. You understand? So you read the story many, many times, you catch up on things, but more important are going to be the teachers are going to then teach you and point out what it is to be learned from the stories. Right? So then problem is people miss the point because of, you know, so much of the story or this or that. But it's still the best medium, as we see even the topmost philosophy is given in the Bhagavatam, which is story form. So that's not the problem. The problem is you have to make it more obvious, more direct. So therefore then Narada instructs that to Vyasadeva, so then he compiles the the Bhagavatam. Now they want to know how does Parikit meet Sukadeva, so therefore then there's so many chapters then on how Krishna and the Pandavas are interacting, and then how it comes after the battle down to the point with Ashwatthama, and then Parikit, and then like this, and then his curse by Sringi, and then he meets, you know, goes to the bank of the Ganga, and then he meets Sukadeva Goswami. Right? So this then concludes the first canto. In this then, naturally then, you're establishing Krishna as the supreme person. Okay, but then we see that in doing that, the first point that is made is protection, right? Is poshana. Is because if we are going to, means the living entity in the material world thinks they are God, right? They're trying to be the supreme controller, supreme enjoyer, right? Now, if you're a controller, then what does that do? That ensures that your enjoyment's going to be fixed, right? I have certain enjoyment I want. Therefore, I have to control the environment in which that enjoyment can be had. Right? I own my house, or I have the, I lock up my house, my possessions of which I, how you say, can interact with persons, the, how you say, the environment in which I can do that is safe, because I control it. Control means safety. Safety means confidence. Right? Security. Right? If I'm confident, then I can act. If I'm not confident, even if I am in the environment of attachment or enjoyment, I can't enjoy. Right? How many opportunities are there that someone could have a pleasant time, but they can't because they're too much insecure? They're too mental. Right? Very common thing. Everything is there, everything's obvious, but they can't enjoy themselves or they can't interact with each other because they're insecure. Right? So that's why then there's so much endeavor by the living entities in the material world to control their environment. Right? If you look at all basically fighting that's going on as who's in control, not who's enjoying, because everybody wants to enjoy. That's not the problem. Who's in control of the enjoyment? Right? So that's because they want that security. Does that make sense? So then if I'm going to say Krishna is God and I'm not, that means he's the controller, enjoyer, I'm not, then that'll make me insecure. That'll be the first step. So who am I? So therefore, immediately it's shown in the pastimes how Krishna is protecting the devotees. Does that make sense? He protects them, he maintains them. So therefore, you don't have to worry about controlling and enjoying because Krishna is the supreme controller and enjoyer. And if you connect yourself with him, then things will go fine. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. Yeah. Then we establish that, you know, he's the supreme lord, like that. Bhishma Dev says so. Kunti says so. Everybody says so. Right? And it goes very nicely. It works very smoothly. And we see results are very nice. So Therefore, and we also understand that that depth of relationship, that's the most important, because the material world's temporary anyway. Therefore, we see the Pandavas, you know, they've gained, they've lost everything, they've gained everything, but still, that's not the important thing. The relationship with Krishna is what's important. Right? Because in the material world, everything's going to go anyway. No matter how much you try, it's going to disappear on you. So whatever you're the most attached to, the most, you know, needful of in your expression of your relationships, it will all go at some point or another. Because that's just the nature of the material world, right? You know, like a fire is flickering. So the light staying on any one specific point on the wall, it's always moving, right? It's never the same. Light's always there, but it's always moving. So that means attachments are always there, but they're always changing. Right? So since the living entity is by nature attached, being energy of the Lord, therefore, then why not connect to that original source? Right? Because Krishna is eternal. He doesn't change. He's unchanging. So by connecting to Him, then we don't have to worry that our relationship's going to adjust or change. Yeah? Does that make sense? Okay. Then, so all this being established very nicely, then we come across Sukadeva Goswami. So then he comes. So now, what is the most important thing for someone to do? Right? So that, of course, is then to worship the Supreme Lord. So now, how do you worship the Supreme Lord? Because the point is whatever your position is, you're going to have to function from there. Right? So you're trying to understand the Lord, so therefore you have Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. Right? So our understanding is that of Bhagavan. We've understood of the three, Bhagavan is the Supreme. But now that understanding should mature. Right? Isn't it? So therefore then seeing this, then we see how Krishna has entered everything. Because as a person, then we have that relationship, but it is not as developed as it can be. Right? Because it's distracted by our interest in the material energy. Right? We ourselves are distracted by the material endeavor. Right? We have our own ideas of what we want to do and what is interesting and important for us. So that's what we do, not Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? So that means then how to see that what actually you're looking for is Krishna anyway. Right? Even the non-devotees, what they're looking for is Krishna. Right? Because the soul can't relate to anything other than what's spiritual. Because it's spiritual, so naturally you relate to what's spiritual, right? You relate to what's your own, right? It means relationship is based on what is common, right? So when there's common elements, then you're able to have establish a relationship, right? Then you can interact. Then whatever are the differences in that relationship, then that will also then create bringing those differences together according to proper, in the proper way, then that creates the pleasure. You understand? The commonality creates the attraction. Right? And proper interaction in relationship to the difference creates the pleasure. Does that make sense? Right? In other words, the intelligence does two things. It sees what's common and what's different. But unless there's something common, how will you have a relationship? Right? But it's in what's the difference that creates the, the pleasure or the rasa. Does that make sense?
Can you just give an example?
Give an example. Okay. The common element of nurturing and needing to be nurtured is there between a parent and a child, right? So that's what makes the commonality. That's what makes the interest for the relationship, right? But the taste is the difference. One's a parent, one's a child. You understand? So if both act according to the proper, etiquette, then that's where the pleasure, if they interact on that, that's where the pleasure is found. Does that make sense? Because if it's too common, then it just stays like that. Okay, you get two ladies who are both mothers together, they have a relationship, because that's what's common. They're both mothers, they can talk about their children. So, but their pleasure will be talking about the different children. So the difference is there. You understand? So like that. Does that make sense to everybody? Right? So the whole point is the commonality is the spiritual. So us and Krishna. That's the common. Then the pleasure is in the difference, right? He's the creator, we're the created. Does that make sense? So that's where the elements or the rules come in, is how to properly interact. Because there is a difference. Right? So because of the difference, then in interacting, if you bring those together properly, then there'll be the most pleasure. Right? Just smiling because that's understood. That's the reality. But unfortunately, the living entity doesn't work on that. You know, just like, let's say, husband and wife fight. Right? So then it's considered to be not a proper thing. But the point is it's the most distance they can get. So if you follow the proper etiquette, then it brings it together, and then their happiness is even greater than before they fought. Right? So it's the same principle. But people don't know this. Right? That's why women always create fights. But unfortunately, the men don't know how to behave, so therefore it remains a fight instead of getting better. Okay, that's a side point. So, now that brings us then to the second canto, where then Krishna is explaining that seeing me in everything means, since you want to connect with me, you have to see me in everything, then you'll always be connected with him. Right? Then one interacts with those elements that Krishna is seen in according to the proper etiquette, proper rules and regulations, then that pleasure is found. Does that make sense? Do we catch the logic there? Right? Means there must be something common. We have nothing in common with dead matter. Right? We only have something in common with spiritual, with Satchitananda. Eternality, knowledge, and bliss. Right? So the material world is ignorance, temporariness, and pain. What's in common? Nothing. Right? So, therefore, Krishna has to enter into everything so that there is something common for us to interact with. Right? But due to ignorance, we don't see it's Krishna that we're interacting with. We see it's that's the dead matter that we're interacting with. Does that make sense? Right? Every child, in interacting with their parent, doesn't matter what culture or what social status, right? They get the same experience. No different. You know what I'm saying? So that means there's a potency of, you know, parenthood there, or motherness, or fatherness, or uncleness, or grandfatherness, or like this, that is there in, empowered in that matter. Does that make sense? So the child is thinking, yes, this potency that is nice, that is nurturing, that's taking care, that's doing everything, this is my mother. Right? But actually it's Krishna's potency of motherhood that's doing it. It's not the dead matter. Right? Dead matter is dead matter. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. So that principle applies in everything that we interact with. Right? We're thirsty, so then we drink the water. But the body is dead matter, the water is dead matter. But the taste that's in the water that is appreciated when we're thirsty, that's Krishna. So that's what we're interacting with. But we think it's the water. But actually it's Krishna. You understand? So then That's what the second canto is all about. How to see Krishna in everything, at all times, all places, all circumstances, and to the most minute detail. This is what the Chaturshloki is explaining, right? And so then the beginning stage will be appreciating how the Lord has entered the creation. It means we're appreciating Him directly as the deity, as the holy name, as the scripture, as the devotees, as much as we can, right? As according to our faith and realization, then that much we're appreciating. But now, what do we do with the time of the day that we're not appreciating in this way? That we're distracted by, you know, family, friends, and bodily concept, and wealth, and sense gratification, and all that, right? Which can be a lot of the day, right? You know? So that's where then this understanding comes in. Is because those things that you're distracting us, those are also Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? So it's not the thing that's important, it's the potency of Krishna in it that's important. Right? So then one can say, well, if it's Krishna, then I can enjoy it however I want. No. Since when do we enjoy the deity how we want? No. You worship the deity in a particular way. Right? There's regulation. Therefore, if it's Krishna that is there in the water, therefore I drink the water in a particular way. Right? And deal with the water appropriately. Because if the taste is Krishna, therefore I have to respect Krishna in the water according to how He comes in the form of water. Right? Does that make sense? Just like Krishna comes in the form of the holy name. So there's etiquette there. How we chant, you know, when we chant, how we use the beads, like that. No? Same way with the deity, a different form of Krishna. So we deal with the deity differently. Right? We don't keep them like we keep our beads in a bag, right? We don't keep the deity in a bag, right? No, we dress the deity. We don't dress the beads. You understand? So like that, then we have these different forms. So as Krishna comes in the different forms, then we respect Him in those different ways. Right? That is actually the rules of Varnashram. Is how to respect Krishna, you know, Krishna's, you know, in the form of the Brahmanness in a Brahman. Or the Kshatriyaness in a Kshatriya, Vaishyaness in a Vaishya, Shudraness in a Shudra, or Brahmachariness in a Brahmachari. Right? Or age in an elderly person, or wealth in a wealthy person, or influence in an influential person, right? Or knowledge in a knowledgeable person, or devotion in a devotional person, right? That's what's actually going on, right? But unless one understands this point, then it just becomes rules and regulations that, of course, it can never be followed because the living entity doesn't want to follow them because the living entity wants to be God. And if I follow Him means I'm not God, because God means I do whatever I want. No, God means He does whatever He wants, and we interact with Him according to His rules. So, therefore, the Vedic system is His rules how to interact with Him. Right? So you think, why do I have to deal, you know, with my parents in this way? It's dead matter. Technically, you don't. There's no difference between, you know, your parent and, you know, the pillar here. Same matter. Maybe a little bit difference. There's a little less water and stuff in this one, and there's a little bit more water in, you know, the parent. But otherwise, the earth, water, fire, air, ether is the same. Right? But the parentness of Krishna, His potency, is there, and that must be respected. That's why it says one always respects the parents. Right? Even if they're not devotees, it doesn't matter. Right? Prahlad Maharaj behaved, if you look at it, all the wording and everything he did, he always behaved very respectfully with his father, even though he's a big demon. Right? Didn't mean he agreed with him. Right? Respect doesn't mean you agree. Respect means you behave properly. Does that make sense? That's the thing. Sometimes it's said that, oh, to respect means you have to do what they say. No, respect means you follow etiquette. So therefore, you'll sit properly, you'll do this, that, those kind of things. But what is your value system and what's your philosophy? That they can't dictate. Right? You know what I'm saying? They're your parents as a body, not parents as a soul. Right? Does that make sense? They're the controller of your body, not your soul. Soul's Krishna, so therefore that goes that direction. Right? For those who think they're the body, then of course the parents are in control. Does that make sense? But for those who don't, then they follow the etiquette, but they don't get involved. Does that make sense? If they're not devotees. Okay? Does that make sense? So that's the whole element, is that the etiquette is there, so that's what you're doing. You're worshipping Krishna in this form. But it's indirect, because that's why it said it's the material form of the Lord. Because it's His potency coming through the material. So that's the beginning stage. So those who remind you of that there, then we'll start to see that's His potency. Then with time you start to see that it's Paramatma. Because otherwise, how does the potency get there? Right? The Garbhodakshaya Vishnu has expanded His potency into everything, and He's entered everything as Paramatma. Right? So then His potency is there, but then the person is also there. Right? So that's the next stage of realization in this. Then the third stage is that, okay, the parentness is there, and that reminds you of Krishna's parents, and then His interaction with Mother Yashoda. So then now the material distraction has been completely turned around. You know what I'm saying? So now it also then becomes just like worship of the deity and other things, that you're remembering Krishna. That now you do these things and then you remember Krishna. Right? But the first stage is there, then you're becoming liberated because you see Krishna in it, and so you're acting for His pleasure. If you act for your own pleasure, then it becomes pious. I mean, it's how you say, it's elevating, but it won't liberate you. But if you're dealing with the interaction with the material energy without a desire for result, that will liberate you. Right? You see Krishna's potencies in it, then that will bring you to Krishna. Right? So you have two things, is getting out of the material world and getting into the spiritual world. Right? You get out of the material world by performing regulated activity, means, how you say, appropriate activities or performance of your duties without a desire for the result. That will liberate you. Whether you're a devotee, not devotee, nothing, just like that. That's what gets you out of the material world. Right? You perform the duty without a desire for result. So then, you know, activities give results. You don't want a result, therefore the whole thing finishes. Does that make sense? Yes, no? So even the impersonalist will say the same thing. Prabhupada mentions, when it comes to liberation, what they say and we say about the process is the same, because it is. Because actually liberation is a process of bhakti. It's a side, it's a derivative of bhakti. But for the impersonalist, that becomes their all in all. Right? That's for them is the ultimate. Yes? Does that make sense? So that's where their mistake is, because they think that's where it ends. If I become liberated, then that's the end, right? Or if I perform a pious activity, then I'll get a fruit or result, you know, for the karmi, that's the end, right? But the devotee performs the activity without a desire for the result, so therefore they get the pious result and they get liberation, but their purpose is because it pleases Krishna, right? That's why they get Krishna. Does that make sense? That's the difference then between the karmi, the jnani, and the devotee. Because the karmi and jnani are following actually technically a process of devotional, that's in devotional service. Right? Of sadhana bhakti. But Krishna is removed from it. So therefore they don't get the benefit of devotional service. Right? We were discussing yesterday. Agyata Sukriti means you're performing devotional service, but you don't know it's devotional service. Therefore, you don't actually get the benefit of it being devotional service. It's a jnata sukriti. It stays with you like devotional service, doesn't go away. And if you compile enough If you're blessed with enough agyata sukriti, then that can, by the association of devotees, turn into faith and then become bhakti. Right? Does that make sense? That's why Krishna says the more you understand about something, then the more you are going to get benefit from it. Right? So he's asking Nanda Baba, why you do the sacrifice? He says, I don't know. We've just always done it. So he says, therefore, then how much benefit you'll get? You'll get some benefit, definitely, but you won't get as much benefit if you knew what you were doing. Right? Therefore, know that Govardhan Hill is actually the source of your happiness. So worship him. Why you worship this Indra? Right? Govardhan Hill is providing everything, not Indra. So worship him. Right? You're worshiping Indra because he provides things for you. Okay, but why you do this ritual and why in this way, you don't know. So therefore, worship Govardhan Hill. He actually produces everything for you and all that. So Indra didn't really appreciate that, but whatever, that's another story. So, right? Does that make sense? So that same principle, the more you know, the more benefit you get. So when you know what's going on, then that's when you get the devotional benefit. When you don't know, then you get basically devotional piety, but it hasn't actually turned into devotional service. You understand? So there's mundane piety that will give rise, means you perform an activity, the desire to perform it again is generated along with it. So if it's sinful act, you'll desire to do the sinful act again. If it's pious act, you'll desire to do a pious act again. But if it's a devotional pious act, you'll desire to do a devotional pious activity again. Right? So therefore, one agyata sukriti leads to another. And then eventually, that, by the association of devotees, can be then turned into faith in devotional service, faith in Krishna. Okay? Does that make sense? So now, you're taking all these different activities and you're connecting it to Krishna. So then, having connected these things to Krishna, then that frees one from the material entanglement. The more one's freed from the material entanglement, the more one can focus on Krishna, right? But we see that in this, the process, this also gives rise to another element that's very important in the process, is that you're performing these activities, seeing Krishna in it, but you keep doing it because what's the problem, right? If you have attachment for it, your motivation is because your attachment. But you don't have your attachment for it, you still interact with it because it's Krishna. Does that make sense? So, therefore, the grihastha, he will be engaged in the family life, and as his practice, then he'll see Krishna in all the elements of it. But once he's seeing Krishna in all the elements of it, doesn't mean he gives it up. Because it's still favorable, because he's still seeing Krishna in it, and there's still the family is favorable to devotional service, so therefore it goes on. Does that make sense? Right? Let us say, I'm attached to management, therefore I endeavor to become a temple manager. But having become the temple manager, then by performing devotional service to please Krishna, I become purified. So now I no longer want to be a temple manager because it's important for me. Right? I just want to serve Krishna. But since I have managerial ability, that's my conditioned nature, then why I wouldn't use that for Krishna? You understand? Right? So, therefore, because I was comfortable or needed the environment of grihastha life, therefore I'm in it. But as I don't need it, I'm comfortable in it because that's the conditioned nature. So, therefore, as long as it's favorable, there's no need to not function within it. Right? So, it may change from active grihastha life into vanaprastha, but if it's favorable, then you're still with the family, right? Still with the wife, right? The children will do whatever they do. But if that's not favorable, either for one or other or both, then that maybe, you know, the vanaprastha will take on a different form, and husband and wife would be separated. Right? She needs to be with the family, with the grandchildren, so therefore she's there and he needs to be doing more sadhana. And so therefore it works. You understand? So therefore, if you're attached to it, you're naturally going to deal with it. If you're not attached to it, what's the problem if you deal with it or not? You understand? So that gives rise from here. So that means the proper etiquette and culture will still be there, right? Does that make sense? So therefore, then you would have, like, a practical application is, therefore, temple devotees, because they don't have a need for grihastha life, doesn't mean that they deal with the congregation of the grihasthas badly. They don't need it, but it doesn't mean they can't deal with it. Right? Or the brahmacharis don't have a need for women, therefore they behave badly with the women. No, there's no need to. If there's nothing to, they have nothing to gain from the women, it doesn't mean that they can't follow the etiquette. Right? The grihastha is following the etiquette because he wants to live with them, but the brahmachari can follow the same etiquette, but he doesn't live with them. Does that make sense? So the culture goes on. The whole point is then the culture remains intact. Despite whatever it means, doesn't depend upon what level of realization you're on. So in the beginning it's from attachment, but with time it's not from attachment. It's because it's either it's duty, so it's being done, but higher than that is that you're interacting with Krishna, so it's your duty towards Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? And so, therefore, there's relationship. Therefore, you have the feminine, Krishna's potency of feminineness in the lady, and then Krishna's potency of brahmachariness in the boy. So how does the brahmachari potency deal with the feminine potency? So therefore, it's very restricted, but it doesn't mean it's not proper. Does that make sense? You see how it works? Otherwise, it's just the duty, or otherwise it's attachment, therefore I do it. Right? But you can see as the more attachment is involved, actually the quality will be less, because then it's according to your attachment. As you come to the platform of duty, then the quality will be better. But as you see Krishna's in it, and actually that's why we're performing the duty, then that gives you greatest. Right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? Yes. So that is then the Vedic culture, right? That's Vedic culture. That's why it's hard to say that it's the rules, it's this, it's that. No. All those are part of it, but the real thing is Vedic culture is how to interact with Krishna in everything that Krishna enters into. Right? Because if we say we're not the body, yes, we're not the body, but our body is empowered with certain potencies because we're taking on certain roles. Therefore, to say I'm not the body and therefore I do whatever I want, then is that God conscious? No. Does that make sense? So that's not a solution. I'm not the body, therefore since I'm not the body, what do I care if I follow the duties of the body or not? Right? So therefore, since this is what Krishna wants, I follow it. Does that make sense? If I'm not the body, therefore I can do the duties of the body. Right? So therefore you actually end up with the opposite of what the living entity that thinks he's the controller and enjoyer, how he would approach it. Right? You know what I'm saying? Because if you think you're God, that's masculine. So therefore, you're not going to be able to perform your part as Krishna's energy, which is feminine, very properly. Right? A girl who's acting as a boy will never actually perform her duties as a girl very well. Right? But at the same time, she'll never really be a good boy. You know? Like that. You know, there's going to be some shortcoming there. You know, you get tough, you get cool, you get out there and, you know, for a little rumble, you know, with the boys, and you break a fingernail. Ooh! You know, so, you know, these things are going to be there. Okay. So, does that make sense? What's going on? So that's the first canto. It's establishing that it's all right to be a devotee, and it's not a bad thing that you're giving up being God and now taking up as servant of God. And those who have done it, it's worked well for them. Right? Even in the most difficult situations. You can't get a more difficult situation than, you know, Draupadi in the court, or the Pandavas losing everything, or Bhishma Dev lying on the battlefield, on the bed of arrows on the battlefield, or, you know, the separation of someone so important to you like Kunti. So it worked out for them and they're doing fine. So it's actually okay for you to be a devotee, and if you do it, you know, you'll also get a good result. Right? Then we bring now to this process of how those things that distract you, how to see Krishna. Because we're using it, what's distracting us, because that's where the inspiration is, right? In the spiritual world, then they're spontaneously attracted to Krishna. Right? So therefore, they look for Krishna in everything that is of importance to them. You know, therefore all the rules and regulations and Vaikuntha and the opulence, it's Krishna's opulence, it's Krishna's rules, it's Krishna's culture, you know, it's Krishna's greatness, it's like this. So they see Krishna in what's important for them. Well, then, like Vrindavan, then it's just that affection, that niceness, so they see Krishna in everything there. So the principle is the same, see Krishna in everything, right? But here, our seeing in everything, we see our attachment in everything. So now we have to see is actually what we're attached to is not the dead matter, it's the Krishna. So then in this way we see Krishna in everything. Right? So we're trying to convert from, you know, this principle to the other. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? We're trying to convert our material attachments into spiritual attachments by pointing out that what we're attached to, therefore, is Krishna. So in the beginning, if you're too attached to something and you're just dealing with it however you want, you'll be distracted too much. If you deal with it according to the rules and regulations, then you'll be able to observe it with knowledge. Then you can start to see Krishna's here or not. Then with practicing that, that will become the prominent, and the impetus from attachment, that will be secondary. Does that make sense? Right? Then we'll see then we're able to establish this point. And then as we establish that, then being able to establish Krishna in everything becomes very easy. If you can catch it in one thing of your attachment, then you can very easily start to catch it in everything else. Then when you catch that, then you're always just seeing Krishna. Right? So that's what sadhana is that process of bringing you closer and closer to Krishna. Right? So that gives Krishna pleasures that the living entity is trying. Right? That's his satisfaction. Right? Does that make sense? So this is then teaching the second canto. Then from there it'll take us to higher and higher stages of this. Right? The first is just on our mundane attachments. That's where the Vedic culture then excels. It gives the form of all attachments. Whatever possible attachments there are in the Vedic culture. Right? So now how to approach those with the proper rules and regulations that we're able to see it with the proper intelligence that we can actually see that what is the working element within all our attachments of the whole Varnashram system is actually Krishna. Does that make sense? Very, very clear scientific process. Very clear. Very easy. That's why it's sometimes hard to define Vedic culture, because people take it as a body of rules, or it's this, or it's coming from... No, it's the process, it's the principles on which various details of processes one building on the other is there to realize our relationship with Krishna. That's the Vedic culture. That's why someone can start out, you know, wearing a suit and tie and be making advancement, because he knows that, okay, I'm here, I'm supposed to behave like a gentleman, so therefore in the Western culture, a gentleman wears a suit, therefore I am doing it. Right? To the point where, because I'm a devotee, therefore I'm wearing now these clothes like Krishna wears in Vrindavan. Right? Because in Vrindavan, Krishna wears dhotis and kurtas and chadars, and girls wear saris. That's what they wear there, right? You have somebody you like to wear their clothes, right? Yes.
So if we find some elements of what you have just said, that there are some elements of culture which are bringing, try to bring people to God, and it is really somehow working, and if we find those in other dharmas of the world, can we say that those have some elements of Vedic knowledge in them?
Now, of course, I mean, religion comes from God. So if there's anything of any religion anywhere that's working, it's because it comes from God. Non-violence comes from God. That's why Buddhism works. Being kind, compassionate to others, you know, like that. Having devotion to God, you know, like that. That comes from you know, Sanatan Dharma, so therefore then Christianity works, right? Or regulating your life in terms of how God wants you to live, that's the Vedic principle, therefore Judaism works, or the Islam works. You know, that there's one God, therefore these others work. You know what I'm saying? So there's some element that's there, of course.
That's we can conclude that whatever brings people closer to God, in reality, this is Vedic.
Yes, like that. But the point is the form, there is a natural form of Vedic culture, but the principles will work in any manifestation. You just have to know that, then it will naturally take you through. That's why Krishna Prabhupada says it's automatic. If you follow the process properly, automatically you'll get there. Like that. So that's why you start from wherever you are, it will get you to that point. You know? But that has to be appreciated. It's not the detail that is important. The detail has its importance in that it regulates the life, in which now you can, through regulation and knowledge, then you can understand how things, what they are. That will generate then that detachment, right? It means detachment and love. The devotional service will give knowledge and detachment, and then those things that you're not technically engaging directly in devotional service, by dealing with them according to the regulations with knowledge, that will also then generate the detachment, right? Does that make sense? So from both angles you try to catch, okay? So let's, because we only have a few more minutes. Now, that brings us to the second canto, right? So now how this study guide works, we mentioned it's around the questions, but it's trying to take what's the most important elements of it first, right? And then from that, gain that. So therefore it opens with the pratigya. Means solemn statement of purpose. Means what does this chapter do? What the point it gets across? What's this, what does it do? What's its relationship in the canto? What is it adding? Why it's there? So here, the first step in God realization, so that's the name of the chapter, is directly given by Srila Prabhupada in his purport to the invocation Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Then quoting here, the first chapter describes the glories of chanting, and it hints at the process by which the neophyte devotees may perform meditation on the universal form of the Lord. Right? In other words, chanting is the most important element, but those things that are distracting you from the chanting, right? You chant 16 rounds a day. What do you do with the other 22 hours of the day, right? So there's some distraction there, right? You may be engaged in some service, you're doing some book distribution, some deity worship, this and that, but there are times when you're not, right? So if you're always chanting, then you don't have to worry about the universal form because you're already seeing Krishna in the name. Right? But if you're distracted by elements of the universal form, therefore you have to be able to see Krishna in those elements, that will bring it back, then you'll just chant the holy name. Okay? So that's what it's hinting at. Right? So this universal form, meditation on that is what the second canto is given, but it's not as a meditation as such. You see it externally presented because that's what will be noticed by the impersonalists and other persons like that. That they learn that God has a form. But we already know He has a form. Now it's that we're looking more at the potencies. So they look at this is the form of the Lord. Okay, this is the arms, this is the legs, this is of the universal form. So they accept that God has a form. We're looking more at the potencies that are there. So therefore, you know, like the in that one song, right? Krishna Mata, Krishna Pita, Krishna Pranadan. Right? So how is one person your mother, your father, and your, you know, dear most? Right? Because whatever it is that we're seeing in our mother, that's actually Krishna. Whatever we're seeing in the father, that's actually Krishna. Whatever we're seeing in anybody else's dear, that's actually Krishna. So actually Krishna is the one nourishing us. Krishna is our protector. Krishna is our friend and who gives us affection. Right? So then you just transfer it from one to the other. Right? Okay. So then, okay, now he's saying here, compares aims of the first and second cantos, briefly, most memorably, summarizes the aim of the 10 chapters of Canto 2 as a whole, right? So he's showing 1 and 2, their relationship, and, but at the same time, summarizes the second. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the principles of creation are described, and thus the first canto may be called creation. Similarly, in the second canto, the post-creation cosmic manifestation is described. The different planetary systems are described in the second canto as different parts of the universal body of the Lord. For this reason, the second canto may be called the cosmic manifestation. There are 10 chapters in the second canto, and in these 10 chapters, the purpose of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the different symptoms of this purpose are narrated. Right, so the purpose is to develop love for Krishna. But seeing Krishna in this way, we should see directly, but if not, through his manifestation, right? Before he's created it, right? So because of protection of the living entities, because of maintenance of the living entities, therefore the cosmic creation is there, the primary creation, right? So in this, what is there, it may or may not, you may see is that because in the second canto he's going to describe the creation. So you, why is the first canto called creation? Because creation is there. He's saying here the second cosmic manifestation, because there's primary and secondary. Primary means Krishna, Krishna's creation, right? Secondary means Brahma's creation. So the point of the universal form is seeing the Krishna, who is the primary creation, in the secondary creation. Does that make sense? So, but the primary creation is there because Krishna is the protector and maintainer of the living entities. Right? Therefore, he's created it. And he's made all these different forms and potencies and everything so that the living entity actually can be protected and maintained. But unfortunately, they don't see Krishna in it. Right? But the devotees, then therefore the devotees come, they perform activities in the material world, and it's pastimes, right? Even though it's in the material world, pastimes means where you're interacting with God. Does that make sense? Right? Because we're always trying to see what's underlying the thing. What is the reason behind something? Right? There's the form of it, as we mentioned. A relationship is there. There's a form of it. So Krishna loves the living entities, right? But the form of it then comes in. He creates the material world for those living entities that are ignoring him and pretending to be God. And so he can interact with them through the material energy. So they interact with the material energy. They think they're God. They're the controller and enjoyer. They're masculine. And the material energy is feminine. And so they enjoy it. But actually, it's the other way around. Krishna then comes and empowers that potency. He interacts with those living entities. So he's still having his pastimes. But the living entity doesn't understand that. Therefore, it's not called pastimes, it's called Maya. But when the living entity recognizes Krishna in the material sphere and engages everything in Krishna, then it's still called pastimes. Pandavas is pastimes, even though they're dealing with material energy. You understand? Because it's Krishna's energy. Superior, inferior, but it's still Krishna's energy. You can't. It's not that pastimes only happen in superior energy. You know, superior facility is there in superior energy, but it's not that it's necessarily any difference in devotion. You know what I'm saying? Prabhupada deals with the spiritual energy and serves Krishna, and Prabhupada deals with material energy and serves Krishna. There's no difference in his devotion. Right? Just the facilities are limited here. Right? You know, there is time, there is space, so that gets in the way. But in the spiritual world, there is no time, there is no space. Does that make sense? You want something. There's a tree there that has a flower on it. You just reach, and, you know, if you take your hand, you can see the flower and you have your finger. You just pick it. Because there is no time and space. So therefore, you just pick the flower. It's not that your arm grows or something. It's just there's no time and space. So it appears that there is for pastimes, but when you pick the flower. But here you have to actually get up on a ladder and climb the tree and get the flower because there is time and space. So it's inferior matter. I mean, it's inferior energy, but still the devotion goes on. Right? So here you spend the time, half the time picking the flower. There, less time flower and more time doing other things. But in any case, you're always engaged. Okay? So then here, this is given the thing. Now, okay, the holy name, here both terms, pretty good chapter. Okay. The glories of chanting. So he mentions that the glories of chanting have been the prominent thing. So then he brings out the verses that bring that out, right? Okay? And so then he quotes from other places. Then we see on the fourth page is that he's explaining the holy name. So all this is then, in other words, you've already gotten that glories of the chanting is the essential point of this chapter, and introducing us to the topic matter of the second canto, in which the universal form is there. So now he's bringing out how the glories of the chanting are there, right? So then we see through the fourth, like that. And now here we see is that it goes on, he gives different quotes from different personalities. Here he's quoting from this, Raghavacharya? Raghava Goswami, in the fifth and sixth parts, like that, all the way through even the seventh. Okay. Then that gives us now the summary of the chapter, so we know what the essence is, right? Summary means what is the essential point. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So now then this brings us to the next part of the chapter study. The Adhyaya Prakash, that will be the chapter at a glance, right? Like Prabhupada gives his summaries, right? So in here then it's the same thing, just bringing out, because I think they start from the fifth canto anyway, but it brings out kind of what's going on in the chapter, so you can get an overview of how these essential points that were given in the Pratigya then are now, what is the form that they're manifest through, what pastimes, what interaction, what philosophical points. Does that make some sense? Right? In other words, this is the essential point of the chapter. That has to be manifest through some form, right? It is a Purana, so it's manifest through a pastime, right? So you want to show, let's say, Yudhishthira's humility, right? So you can show it in so many ways. So it's shown, let's say, one pastime is he shows it through that he's been called to the gambling match by Dhritarashtra. But because he is submissive to his authorities, Dhritarashtra is his authority who raised him. Therefore, he, out of humility, goes to this program, even though he knows it's not correct. So that's one way of seeing his humility. Does that make sense? Right? Another way, as you could see, is that they've had this big battle, he's won the war, he is the emperor, but he's thinking, so many people have died for me to be the emperor and all this, and so therefore I'm a very sinful person, rather than going, yes, we won the war, and now we're back where we're supposed to be. Does that make sense? So in the same way as the pratigya means your essence, your statement of purpose of the chapter, it must be manifest through a form, a pastime. So we see it through this pastime. Okay? And so then that is what goes on here. So that gives it overall at a glance, right? Then we see the specifics so that we're clear of it. Then we go into actually what the shlokas go through. So in shloka anusharanam, then that's the next on page 9, 1.3. Then we see is then summarizing or grouping the verses according to how they actually are common. So we see here 1 through 6 has a common point. Also questions 26 and 27 come up, right? That's what's going to then generate the next discussion, right? In other words, the present discussion is a generation of the previous questions, right? And now it's just like karma, right? I perform something now, I get a result later. Then in that position of result, then what happens next, right? So that's what's going on. So the question generates the next discussion. So that comes up here. Nimeshas, then you'll see here, these are points that are brought out. This will be Sahota Maharaj here himself, or others that have been brought up that, you know, so that you're aware, you know, of some subtle points or things that are here, bringing in quotes from other places. But you see as 1 to 6 go together. So if that study and the purports and verses are looked in that way, then you'll see, yes, you get more from that. Right? So that will go through the whole chapter in that way. Then you come to Vritti here. He's got a commentary on it. So then now is then he's bringing out essential points that are being philosophical points or cultural points that are being there in the chapter, right? Does that make sense? So we see as we've gone in this way, we've gone through the essential point that is there. Then, you know, if there's need, sometimes that essential point, that's all there is. And then it immediately goes into the next stage. This one, then there's more things that are given to show how that goes. Then it goes into a chapter summary. Then it goes into going in groups of verses. Then you've kind of like gone in the chronological order. Knowing the essence, then you've gone through the chapter, expanding it from essence to what's going on to, you know, more detail. Right? Then in this, then here, sometimes you'll see it's done, sometimes not. Philosophical points will be brought out. Okay? To make sure that it's very clear, because the essence makes the point, then within making that point are so many philosophical points. Right? Like we saw as dealing with Krishna's universal form, then we see how Naishkarmi comes out. We see how engaging, dovetailing all our propensities in the Lord's service comes out. These are all points that comes out of this one point. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So then you'll go through this. He's making these comparisons and everything. Then we see, then we'll get into actually studying the question answers, how the question answers come up, where they were generated from, where it's taking you. Okay? So then that's the next section that is then being given. Then, okay, yeah, now that's going on. Here's the questions. Okay. Now in here, then he's also then showing things in connection with this specific philosophical, Western philosophical positions. How the Western positions are actually just taking part of the Vedic. So because they don't see the whole, then there's a problem. Right? So that brings us to 1.8 on page 19. That is, now we've completed actually the study of the chapter using the verses and the purports. Right? Does that make sense? And any other literature that backs it up, but it's you're directly doing that. So therefore, reading of this then will make, if you've read this first, then when you go through your reading of the chapter and then go back and compare it to this, then you'll start to see, okay, verses 1 to 6, they kind of have a connection to each other. And then you'll see the common points in the purports and everything like that. Does that make sense? Like that. You'll see the essence. So when you go through, then it seems that it's going here and there because it's a conversation, but it actually has the same point it's making. Right? Then the appendix then is giving things that are for, you know, those means this is special points of interest. In other words, the appendix, if you're, you know, we have whether it's full-time students, part-time students. Full-time students means they're taking it as it is going in the speed that the classes are running. You're keeping up with that. Like that. Part-time students means they attend the classes, but they'll move at their own speed. So it's designed that you hear, by hearing the discussions, it makes you understand the depth of what's going on. But it's not that the lecture itself is, you have to hear it when you're doing the other thing. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? In other words, you hear a discussion on second canto, first chapter. It deals with second canto, first chapter. But because of the method of it, the concepts that are there or the methods of inquiry are the same for any chapter. You understand that you're going to go through it and analyze it in this way. Therefore, even someone still on first canto, first chapter, still by hearing that class, because that's what's going on now, then they get the benefit of understanding how to deepen or enter more into Bhagavatam through this study method. Does that make sense? So therefore, the class is going on here, but the person can be studying completely somewhere else in Bhagavatam. But when they're studying somewhere else, then they use the study guide. Right? And ideally, is that facility is there, then they will listen also to the class that was given on that chapter. Right? You know what I'm saying? But it doesn't mean that you have to be at the same stage. So therefore, people coming in at all times can start at any time in this thing and get benefit. Right? Because it's very hard that you're going to, otherwise you have 12 cantos and you basically can do a canto a year or maybe two cantos a year, if it depends how quickly you do. But that means, that would be, you know, 6 years that you're dealing with it. So that means what do with students that come in the second year or the third year or the fourth year. So that either means you have to have 6, you know, Bhagavatam study courses running simultaneously, or you have one running and people can take it at whichever point they're at. So we've decided on the second rather than the first. Right? Western academics will take the first. That's why it's so bulky and big administration and millions of teachers and millions of classrooms. But for the Vedic, it simplifies it. One class works for everybody, right? So the self-study may be different, but their dealing in the class is the same. So here, Vinodakam will be, quote, some of the sandarbhas that bring out the fine details of the philosophical points that are there, right? And so what it is from the sandarbhas, any verses that deal with this chapter are taken out. So then you see, like here, let's see, just as an example. Okay, Sudha Jiva Goswami, Krishna Sandarbha, okay? Verse 1 of chapter 1, canto 2, consults, okay. Okay, so here he's doing in 1.9, 35 to 38. So he's dealing with the same verses, making comments on those. Right? Does that make some sense? So this is a comment on Srimad Bhagavan 2.2.1.1. Right? Then he brings out so many points from there. So it just gives you a deeper understanding like that. So that then goes... So he's quoting from Preeti from that. So he'll mention even what the concept is sometimes. You know, what it is the point that Jiva Goswami is making. So it gives also more understanding of how to go. So then that will go through. Then another reference that is given that we see on page 24, then is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Bhagavad Arthamarichi Mala. That is an analyzation of all the verses of the Bhagavatam according to the Dasamul, right? Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So then he'll say here that, okay, Abhideya division, okay, and in chapter 13 entitled Aikanti Namashraya Sarana Bhakti, taking shelter of the holy name. So in other words, he's bringing out that this chapter is dealing with taking shelter of the holy name. So then he'll give points, which are the verses that point that out. Right, so that you're very sure that when you read through it, that you caught that, you know, these are the verses that are actually bringing those points out. Right, then we see on page 26, these are prominent verses that Prabhupada uses or is, you know, well quoted, like that. You've already studying them just to make sure is that you see is that this is where they're from. Grihamedi subject matters, Grihamedi life, fallible soldiers, Vaidhi Bhakti, remembering the Lord, hearing the Bhagavatam to attain firm faith, Hari Nam, facing death. Right? So there's a lot of them in this chapter. So this chapter is actually quoted a lot. But this is just so that you know, these are the verses if you wanted to have a thing, if you do have, it means those who are running the course, if you do have a, how do you say? Need for having devotees know verses, these are the verses to know, right? So what we do is we want them to know what they mean, and it can explain them in philosophy. If you want, you can have the like MIHE, VIHE, they demand that you memorize them, like that. Which is great if you're a kid, but if you're an adult, then good luck. But so we feel more important is you know what it means, rather than you can know the verse, know the word for word, can give the translation, you know, like that. We would rather the time spent on trying to remember it, you know, rummage around and see if there's still any memory left, you know, like that, you know, so there was some ram here somewhere. Right? You know, so then you just know what it means, because that's what you're going to use in your life. If you can quote it, that's even better. That's the culture, right? But if you can't, you just know what it means, at least you'll be able to use it in your life, help others, okay? Then we see on page 29, then these are the homework assignments. Okay, so then we see here is because the Gurukul boys there are following it. So as kids, then they can do these certain things, and that's all that they need to do, right? So then they'll get something for that, right? They get, you know, for philosophy and all that. But at some point, then they, as they mature, then they also become adult students, and then they take the course here. So that means you got your how do I say, you got ones that you can answer, but the full 193 then are what you have to do, right? So it explains what is the point that you have to write on. Does Does that make sense? And then that some of them have, like on page 33, extra credit. Means above credit. Like let's say if there's 100 marks in this, these writing these things on page 33 will give you beyond 100. You understand? Because you may be strong in some areas, weak in some other areas. The point is that you know Bhagavatam from some angle. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's unique, so something's going to stand out more or less to them. Does that make sense? You know, so someone more the philosophy, someone more the culture, you know, someone more, you know, the pastimes, someone more the questions, someone more certain aspects of the philosophy, the Sambandha more, someone Abhideya more, someone Prayojana more. Does that make sense? Someone will bring out Dwarka pastimes more, someone will bring out Vrindavan pastimes more. Point is that you have an entrance into Bhagavatam. Does that make sense? Yeah? So that's why it's constructed this way. So it's not exactly, it's similar. In other words, if you've been through Western educational process, you'll be able to relate to it. But as you can see, is the basis of it is different than the Western. Because you're starting from essence, working out. Basically, from the Western standpoint of view, you would say, but you're giving them all the answers. You're giving them everything. Where's the point to you know, for them to work it out? The point is we want them to realize it. Realizing only comes from understanding. The Western is you try to understand it. That's the end of the line. They don't care if you realize it or not. Therefore, they make it hard for you. But the Vedic, everything is there. But the point is did you absorb it? Therefore, then the questions and all that, bring that out to see if you do. That's the difference. The Vedic test, you know what are all the points, what are all the answers. Because that's what we want you to know. But the point is which question we'll ask you, that's another. Let's say for the Bhagavatam, there's 100 questions. Right? We can ask you any one of those 100 questions. So therefore, if you want to pass, and so your grade depends upon that. So therefore, you should know all those 100 questions. But all the questions, all the everything's there. But it's not a matter of memorization. Because you can see by the study, what we're going through is not what memorizes, what's understood. So therefore, if you understand that question, that's there. But so there's 100 questions means you got to understand all 100. Otherwise, you may fail. You know, you'd be taking a big risk that, you know, you're going to pick, you know, question 57 for you or something. Understand? Does that make sense? So these assignments that basically makes up these essays that go through here make up most of your grade. Right? Like that. So what's in the chapters, so then at the end of the cantos, then there's essays. I'm not sure if they've been fully worked in, but in the future, if they haven't, then for groups of chapters, they go together. Like the first three chapters of Bhagavatam, first canto, go together. So they'll have an essay, why those are together. Then the next two are Vyasadeva speaking to Narad Muni. Like that, then that goes together, there'll be an essay. There's essays on special points, you know, like the invocation is a special study. The Dasamul, I mean, not Dasamul, the Chatushloki, it's studied in the context of the chapter, but it's also studied on its own. So there'll be two studies of that, you know, in here. So there's a few places where there is something like that, you know, something that's prominent, like Kunti's prayers, then they would have, besides being part of a chapter and being studied in this way, they would be studied on their own. You know what I'm saying? So anything prominent. So then add all that up together. Then there'll be end of canto, then end of the six cantos. Then you add that all up, and then that makes the grade. Does that make sense? So plenty of studying, plenty of writing. But we can see it can be done on one's own time at one's own speed. So someone could go through this very, very quickly, and someone can take years to do it. You know, but it doesn't really matter. You know, point is to learn it, right? Because it's like, even if you get one chapter learned perfectly, you could still go back to Godhead, right? You may not get, you know, your Bhakti Vaibhava degree out of it, but hey, you know, I don't think anybody in the spiritual world is going to worry about that, you know. You know, the Cowherd boys aren't going to say, you know, says, no, you can't come out to play with us. You didn't finish your Bhakti Vaibhava studies. You know, sorry, you know, go back home. you know, like that. But I am home, back to Godhead, right? You know, so, it's, you know, so. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay. Did that do what you wanted? Yeah. Okay. So then time is up. Time to move on to other. Right. Should keep going. Okay. No, I have time. It's just I just that you have an other important engagements like the Shad. Yes. But.
Maharaj, we are talking about relationships and obviously Krishna and the potency of Krishna. Srila Prabhupada, he mentions in the first canto, first chapter, and in the purport 3 that there cannot be any relationships or rasas between man and animal.
Yeah.
So what does he mean? Because we can even see the potency still there.
You can see the potency, but you're interacting with Krishna's potency, so you're interacting with Krishna. But the animal, their language, their this and that, you can get a symptom, but there's no rasa as such. It's just you're giving them food, and so they like food, so therefore they come to you for food. But it's not like, you know, specifically friendship or, you know, parental or conjugal rasa is there. No, it's just how you say it's comfortable, and that's all. And that's what's there. That's why they get together and they have their whole scene going on. You know, you get two dogs together and what's happening there can never happen between you and the dogs. You know what I'm saying? They get together and, you know, the way they you know, bark and, you know, how you say, yeah, make all kinds of funny noises and this and that and, you know, howl and all that. You know, it doesn't make any, doesn't mean anything to us, but to them it's all happening, you know. You know, otherwise it's just convenience, that's all. Yes.
I have a practical question. What would be the quickest and most easy method to enter into this study course with somewhere in the Bhagavatam, since there's some certain canto, let's say third or fourth, and he's studying something? What would be the method to like enter to this practical?
Means using this, or means here? Means just by what's there. I would say is that the points that give the you know the pratigya, the chapter summary, and the shloka anusharanam are going through the shlokas, the essence of the shlokas. I would have a tendency to read that first, then go back and then read the chapter, you know, and in relationship to this, right? So then you get a chronological study, because when you study something, there's two methods. One is the chronology, and two is the theme. Right, but you can't study the theme until the chronology is done. That's just the proper way of approaching a scripture. Right, you don't just go in and skip around. You go in and read from beginning to end, because otherwise you catch some points, you get some knowledge, but you don't actually get the whole mood unless you've read it. So you read. So then, having done that, then you're aware of what to look for when you read it chronologically, and then you can compare it as you go, because that's the most easiest like part. Once you've read it, then go in and start reading the next parts, you know, where it gets right into detail of the philosophy and other things, and especially the parts in Sandarbha. Then go back and look at those purports, you know, or those verses. Then you can see actually much more deep, you know what I'm saying? Because first you're trying to get what's the essence, what's going on in the whole thing, and how everything is kind of connected together. Then you know the chapter. Right? Then you're going back and you'll have caught the philosophical points that are being brought out. That's what's there. Then you go back and read the other parts and then go back and compare them. You know, go back and forth. That's a thematic study. So then you can see is that how much depth is actually there in the purport that you didn't actually catch before. You know, or you thought another point was actually important in the purport when it's something else. Like that, you know. So then, that way, then you can see from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's points and from Jiva Goswami's points, or from points brought out from other places of Prabhupada's own purports, then what was actually meant. Then you have a real clear understanding of the chapter. Also then studying what's the question, then you can see how it's unfolded. So you understand what's actually, the book, how it's working. You know what I'm saying? So you want to understand the chapter, you want to understand how the chapter relates to other chapters, it's the book, you know, so it's like that. Then you'll be confident to write the essay. right? Because what you're trying to do is get that completeness of the study. Then writing the essay will be very easy, like that. You know, so it's some work, but it's not, if it's done in that way, then it works very easily, right? Because otherwise, if you just read the one and go read the other, you may not catch. So read the essential, you know, what it gives the summaries first, then read the chapter, then it'll make sense, then compare the two as you go. Then when you read the other points, they'll make more sense because you've already done it, and then you see that the author then makes reference, compare this to this purport and that, then go back and look at the two. Right? Then you'll see, you know, that's what Prabhupada's meaning. So Prabhupada speaks in this very nice, simple, straightforward way, but what he's saying is extremely deep. Then you look at Jiva Goswami, he's giving a very technical, analytical way, and you'll see that Prabhupada's saying the same thing, but we may not have caught that depth because of the simplicity of presentation. Once you're accustomed to that kind of depth, then you see that when Prabhupada says this, he means this much depth. Then when you read another purports, you'll be able to automatically catch that depth. You have to be made aware of what kind of depth Prabhupada's writing at. Because Prabhupada said everything's in the books, that's what he means. He's read all the works of the Acharyas, he's read all the commentaries. Right? So everything that they say is in his books. But we may or may not catch that. That's why sometimes devotees go to these other things, because they don't connect it. They think there's something deeper there, special. You know, Prabhupada gave basics, they're giving the real deal. But no, Prabhupada gave the real deal, but he just said it very simply. Because if you're a preacher, you have to say it simply. Because if you talk like the Sandarbhas, then your common audience is not going to understand. Even your common devotees not going to. Probably most all devotees aren't going to understand. You know what I'm saying? You're just not going to understand. Even in these, because we don't know grammar, sometimes the grammatical explanation, we don't even catch it that it's grammar. They say, you know, this is the subject here, this is the object. We just go, subject means, okay, that's what it's about. And the object means, okay, that's kind of the focus, but that's the grammatical explanation. Subject, object, so then therefore, what's the verb? That's what's connecting them. Right? We don't like a nectar devotion, it says, Krishna is the supreme subject, Radharani is the supreme object. But I've heard devotees say, well, actually, that doesn't sound right. It should be Krishna is the supreme object because he's what everybody's trying to get to, and Radharani is the supreme subject. But that's because they're trying to put it into, you know, a philosophical, but that's a grammatical explanation. Krishna is the supreme object means he's the supreme doer, and Radharani is the supreme object means whatever Krishna does, she is the supreme object at which he does all his activities towards. So all of Krishna's activities are directed towards Radharani. That's what it's saying. But if you understand grammar, then that makes sense. You don't understand. So there will be some points there that if you know, it'll make sense, and if you don't, it doesn't matter. Like that. You know what I'm saying? Because in English, grammar is not a major... you don't use grammar to explain things in English. Right? You can... But people actually, even, you know, how you say your PhDs in grammar, don't know grammar well enough to explain it. I mean, I know. I've sat right and explained this to a PhD in these kind of things, and they couldn't understand it. It took a long time. It means that the common devotee understood it quicker because they're not conditioned to how English grammar works. They didn't know it existed, right? You know, it was there in school, but they forgot about it. This person was very fixed in grammar, and they couldn't understand what I was talking about for a while. Like that. Because they don't know English as a language. They know English is English, but English is a language. It's a form of language. Language has inherent grammar. Therefore, English... being a language has the same inherent grammar, but they've developed a speculative grammar rather than a real grammar. You know, that reflects language and relationship and communication. They've done one that reflects just trying to make some sense out of how people use English. Is that okay?
Would you comment some devotees who are doing the study on their own, this kind of, that kind of, if they want to really go deeper into the subject matter, to just drop it where they are at and start from the beginning using this study guide?
You could, like that. And if you write the essays and that, then you can get credit for them at some point. But if not, then you just use it'll be means you can read the chapter, then go in and try to find all these elements. Then you can do that yourself wherever you're studying. In other words, try to find out what's the essential point that's there, you know, what are actually being made. So you can do that yourself, like that. But this has already been, you know, very well done. Right?
Like that. Yes, Maharaj, we speak about our way from gross materialism and attachment to pure devotional service. Did I remember correctly that you mentioned in Mahabharata classes that this karma kala level means like we are attached to results, but we like to share our like sense gratification with others.
Basically, that's the better platform. It means better shared sense gratification than just only on yourself. But the point is even if you're only interested in yourself, you have to follow the form of shared. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Means if you want to interact, let's say, with somebody, even if it's totally motivated and you couldn't care less about the other person, still, if you want to get what you want from that person, you have to follow the form of sharing that sense gratification, or even seeing to their sense gratification. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the technique doesn't change. No matter what your consciousness is, the technique of dealing with somebody in a proper relationship doesn't change. So whether you're on Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, or Bhakti, how you interact with somebody doesn't change. The technique, the method. You know what I'm saying? Depending upon your goal, you may choose one relationship over another. You know, you may decide what relationships you want to cultivate. But the method of cultivating a relationship doesn't change no matter what your consciousness is, what your goal is, anything. It can't. Right? Just like you wanna just go for a drive, or you wanna get to the market, or you want to, you know, show off that you're somebody very special and, you know, you got a great car. But so the method of driving the car is exactly the same for all three. Though their goal and purpose is completely different. You understand? It doesn't change. So that's the whole point, is the Vedic system of relationship doesn't change, as the sciences completely seems to evade the Western mentality. Right? Is that this is the way things work. It's not a matter of discussion. You know, it's just like you have a machine that's made by the manufacturer. The manufacturer prints a book on how it works. It doesn't matter what you feel, what you think, what mood you're in, what day of the week it is, what color your hair is, you know, whether you have spikes or whether you have studs, you know, in your nose. It doesn't matter. The machine, you push on, it goes on. You push off, it goes off. You can't push off and it'll go on. You can't not plug it in and it'll work. You can't push play and have it, you know, how you say, rewind. It doesn't matter who you are, what your purpose is. You know, whether you're recording for pleasure, whether you're recording for espionage, it doesn't matter. It works in that way because it was manufactured that way. So God manufactured this creation. It works the way He says. It doesn't matter who you are or who you think you are. It works that way. And all you have to do is say, well, the Westerners like to do it different. Yes, the Westerners do it different. It's called 75% divorce rate. So tell me that their speculative method of doing it their way works. Doesn't. In India, when I came to India, divorce rate was basically zero. Now it may be, you know, by, you know, popular demand and trying to be Western, you know, then it may be higher. But before, it was practically zero. When I came to India, that was in the 70s, let alone going back farther. Because they know how to operate relationships. Therefore, they have them. The Westerners refuse to follow the rules, therefore they don't have them. Right? Why is it everybody's trying to look cool, do their own thing? Because they're trying to attract someone else to have a relationship with them. But the problem in having the relationship, it's centered on themselves. I do like this, I attract the person to deal with me the way I want. Okay, but the problem is they're doing the exact same thing. So you have two people who are attracted to each other with the idea that each one's going to do for me what I want them to do. But it's got to be on my terms. Therefore, it doesn't work. You understand? So the Vedic is you work for the other person's pleasure. You do that, they'll work for yours. You know, but the modern is I work for mine and the other works for theirs. So supposedly you get what you want. But no. But I work for yours, therefore you get yours. You work for mine, therefore I get mine. Much better system. But the Western mentality absolutely refuses to follow this. So that must mean they just want to suffer. They just don't want to have relationships. They want their life to be miserable. They want everything to fall apart because that's the method that they're fully 100% committed to. I want to, the girl wants to be special, be unique, be different, but she puts herself on display as a common piece of meat that anybody and everybody can see. Doesn't sound very special to me. So it doesn't sound like that's the greatest thing. Right? I got a Rolls Royce, I want to sell it, I take it to the flea market here. Right? So how much can you sell it for in the flea market? Oh yeah, okay, I'll give you 150 euros for that thing. Looks, you know, not bad. You know, you're not going to get, you know, 200,000 euros for it. That you have to take it to a very special, exclusive place and show it there. But that's the Western mentality. Completely upside down, absolutely, completely proud of it, and thinking it's the only way in the world it works. But it absolutely doesn't work, otherwise where is the results? Right? Everyone's talking about money. Where is the money? Everybody is scraping for money. Where is this money? Everybody's talking about sense gratification. How many people are down at the disco and they still don't get anyone to go home and go to bed with? Right? So that's the whole point, is if it really was doing what it says it does, then okay. But it doesn't. All you do is have frustrated people that aren't getting anywhere and that they got their own idea how they're going to get there. And it doesn't work. But they're just so committed to it, they won't give it up. That's mine. Yes, sir. That's mine. That which is not. So this whole idea is that we're the ones that are out of date. No, we're the ones that are right up to date. What we do works right now, right today, right this second. What's out of date is the Western thing. They don't even have a date. Right? That's when they're walking around in the streets trying to get one. And even if they get one, they don't know how to keep it. Right? They just hope it'll work. Oh, this is nice. I hope this will last. They have no idea of the science how to make it last. Right? So that's the thing. You know, we're supposed to be some ancient. No, we're the ones that are present. They're the ones that are living in the past or the future. We're in the present. So we're actually the up-to-date person. Right? And everybody else, they're living in, well, I saw like that, Naomi Campbell wore that, you know, and she looked cool. Yeah, but she was being paid $1,000 to do that shot, and then she went and took it off and put on something else. You know? Does that make sense? So like that. Anything else? Yes.
Could you please bring up the point of this Chaturvyuha incarnation of the Lord in connection to seeing Lord everywhere in all the spheres we are perceiving?
Well, that's what the second canto basically does. But basically you have sambandha abhideya prayojana, relationship process and result. So in this then, in sambandha means you have, because you're dealing with male-female, right? So there's various ways you can break, you know, put this all together depending upon how you're looking at it. So in the basic sense is that relationship means you're subject-object or masculine-feminine here, you know, or active-passive. You know, cause it's all the same thing. So, therefore, in it you have the independent masculine aspect, and you have then the masculine aspect that's interacting with the feminine, right? So sambandha is the masculine aspect, right? So therefore, sankarshan is the field, because the field, whether you interact with it or not, it's just there, right? So that is the field of activities. What are all the elements in there? That everything is correct, everything's running properly, everything's like that, right? You know how you say, Krishna says, I come, you know, millennium after millennium to, you know, establish the religious principles, to destroy the demons, to, you know, instate the devotees. That's sankarshan, right? Prajumna means within that field, the masculine that's attracted to interacting with the field. Does that make sense? So everything's included in the field. So you have the field, which is everything. Then interaction of the field, that's abhideya, and result or experience gained, that's prayojana. So sambandha is the big picture, big circle, and everything else is actually abhideya prayojana within that. Then, so that's prajumna. So we see Krishna as prajumna, that's Cupid. That means that he's very, very sweet, very nice, very attractive. You know, Krishna, that's the all-attractive one. That is Madan Mohan, right? So that's that element, where Krishna's interacting with his energy, right? Or desiring to, right? So relationship is being established there, right? The other one is the field's established, so therefore all the elements of relationship are established according to what are the rules of the relationship. And everything functions within that field. But now this is the desire too, so that makes prajumna. Then operating the field, that's Vasudev, right? Because Vasudev is a Leela avatar, right? So he does the pastimes, right? And then Aniruddha is the prayojana, or the result, because result is experienced in the mind. Aniruddha is the lord of the mind, right? The moon. So therefore, the experience gained, results gained, that's Aniruddha. Does that make sense? So therefore, you see a field, that's sankarshan. You can identify a field, okay? Like we've identified a store, okay? You know? And so then, within that store, then we're looking like that and identifying the objects. That's sankarshan. That's why nothing's going on. Right? We're just looking. Then we see, oh, those items, yeah, I can relate to. So then there's the desire to interact with those. So therefore then there'll be interaction. We'll actually pick them up, put them in our basket, you know, and then we buy them, and the result is we have them. Understand? So everything works on this. Relationships, this and that. That's why the biggest mistake is made, is that the men work in the field of sankarshan, which is masculine, which has to be done. But they can't understand why the relationship of the family is not happening. I provide everything. I give the house. I give the money. I take care. I make sure I make all arrangements for them. Why aren't they happy? Because that's sankarshan. There's no interaction. Until it comes to prajumna, there's no interaction. You understand? So that's generally why you can have a marriage where the man's providing everything very dutiful and it still fails. Because he acts as an independent male. He doesn't act as an interactive male. Right? Prajumna is interactive male. Sankarshan is static.
Dead matter.
Hmm?
Dead matter.
It's not dead matter, it's just the elements, because the elements can be people. Right? You know, I mean, sankarshan would mean, okay, there's a house, there's a family, there's a husband and the wife, everyone has their duties, all the duties are being done, we're relating to everything, everyone's acting properly and everything like that. But where's the rasa? It's not there. It's just been nicely organized. That's sankarshan. Prajumna is having this nice field of nicely arranged family life, therefore now I interact with my wife according to the proper, you know, rules and etiquette, with my children, the proper etiquette, they with the parents and the proper etiquette, we as a family with other members of the family or with the community or with the temple, like that. That's rasa, that's prajum. That then, that desire for it then is there. That will bring about then vasudev. Right? So then you will act. Right? And then you will get a result. Does that make sense? So that's the main problem is people identifying what's what. So if you can figure this out, you understand the philosophy, you understand how everything works, you understand how all your relationships work, because that's the whole thing. Is Vasudev Shankarshan Prajumna Nadi Ruda. They are the creation. Right? So that means everything is functioning according to those four. Otherwise, why is there four? Even Krishna, he has those four personalities, which represent each of those. Something like that. You know, Dhiro Datta, he's, you know, defeating the demons and everything like that. Dhira Prasanta, he's the goal, he's the Paramatma, he's the ultimate, you know, stage of life, he's the most lovable person. You know, Dhira Lalita, then he's that one who, you know, desires, that wants to interact with the devotees and all that, very kind, compassionate. Like that. Dhiro Datta, you know, then he's the one who actually performs the pastimes. So Krishna himself, these four moods then give rise to Sankarshan Prajumani and Vasudev. Right? So that's how everything is established. You understand that, you understand the formulas, how the cosmic creation works, not just the universe. Right? So second canto teaches us this. Right? Based on that, then you can do nice devotional service. Is that okay? Yeah.
How can one deal with the statement of certain people who say that religion is opium of the masses?
Religion is the opium of the masses. So, okay, but religion is the opium of the masses. You could say that's one opium of the masses. You could also say consumerism is another opium. But what keeps them inspired? Right? Opium in the masses means what keeps them dull. So what are they doing? They're just working hard, making money, and someone else is making money off of their working hard. So is that not an illusion also? You know, and tell them, it's. They would have to explain it. Tell them nice to quote it, but what did Marx mean when he said it? Actually explain it. Technically, how is it opium? Right? From religion comes the care for other living entities, comes to not steal, that comes to not bother others, the living entities, to respect another person. So where is that opium coming in the modern culture? Right? So therefore, society as people know it, that it works together, is only because of it's derivative from some religion, right? That you're in your house, you don't bother your neighbor. That concept has come from that they were Christians or Jews or Islams. Because if we remove all that and you just get down to, you know, the punky guys on the street, they couldn't care less about anybody but themselves. And then look what chaos it creates. So we could say false ego and self-centeredness and lack of disregard for everyone else is the opiate of the modern man. It's a better religion. At least there's some care for others. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because today in the news we always hear about these militants, that militants.
Yeah.
They are all attached to some religion.
Well,
or at least they claim it.
Yeah, means those in the religion don't seem to claim them. They claim to be in the religion, but people of the religion don't necessarily claim them. Okay. So then they're saying that if there's no religion, then there's not going to be any fighting.
Yes, that's heard that statement.
Okay, so if they say that, then why is it that America and Russia were fighting for so long? Russia was supposedly the non-religious state, but all they were was basically one very large war machine. Right? Stalin, according to official records, killed 20 million people. I mean, I definitely, the Tsar, who was a religious Catholic, I think they blamed him and killed him because 7 million people died between his father and him in wars that they were waging trying to gain land for the Russian people. He killed 20 million, and probably within a few years, you know, like that. That's the official. Going through records, they think it may be 30 to 50 million, and some people say it could be 80 to 100. So that definitely looks like a better stance. That definitely looks like someone who's not. So then you could say that maybe it's, you know, self-sundered, you know, militancy. Maybe that's the opiate. Because Stalin was like that, you know. Hitler was like that. Right? Hitler killed so many people. He wasn't known to be religious. He was anti-Semitic. They weren't specifically Christian, right? So then they would have to explain, well, how does it do there? That's much more people. So maybe it's that when one takes whatever one's belief and takes it to the point of self-centeredness where one's unable to recognize others' position and others' free will, then that's what causes the problem. You know what I'm saying? So it's not, you know, nobody's getting problem from the from Israel, and they can be, it's a Jewish state. You know what I'm saying? The other states happen to be that religion. That's a state based on, here's a bunch of Jews who want to create a Jewish state. So you can't get more religious than that, right? The only thing other than this that would be equivalent would be the Vatican. You know, the Vatican State. That is a religious state. These others happen to be that religion. You know? You know what I'm saying? It means the state wasn't created because of the religion. The state was already there. Here they created the state. You know what I'm saying? To facilitate the religion. So then, no one really gets any problem from them. There's no terrorism coming from Israel or anything. All they're doing is defending themselves against everybody around them. You know, you got 5 million Jews and probably 120, 150 million Arabs surrounding them who kind of wish they didn't exist. So therefore, you know, they're quite good at defending themselves. Now here's a very strong that, but they're not. You know what I'm saying? They're not bothering, they're not going around the world and blowing up things here and there. Right? They're simply trying to defend their own state. You know what I'm saying? Someone could say, well, maybe they're a little rough with the Palestinians, but if you've ever been there, then 30, you know that 30, I think 30 or 40%, no, I think it's more. I think 60, 70% of the Palestinian national, you know, I mean their money of their state is generated from them working in Israel. Right? So what would you say of the people that work in Israel, make their money, so they can maintain themselves so that then they fight against Israel? Right? Doesn't make much sense. You know, if they're, so just make money in their own place. Right? So when it gets too much, Israel closes the doors. Right? And then the Palestinians freak out, and then it's a whole international thing, they got to open the doors, because if they don't open the doors, Palestinian people starve to death, because there's nothing to create, generate money. Right? You know what I'm saying? If it wasn't for oil, then they wouldn't necessarily be a rich nation. All these the Islamic states. Oil is what makes them rich. If they don't have oil, they're not known as rich states. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that. It means, you know, Algiers is also, you know, Arab and Muslim, but is it known for wealth? No, they don't have oil. So then, Morocco, you know. So it's just because they have money that it's there. You know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like that, is that the whole point is it's not necessarily the religion is the process. Everybody has a religion. Science is a religion. Right? You know? Hedonism is a religion. Consumerism is a religion. Like that. Religion means the way that you, means the inherent nature of something, and you put that as the prominent thing. So the Vedic is the inherent nature of the soul and God and his creation. So that's what's prominent. Therefore, you look at everything else. Your dharma, artha, kala, moksha. right? That they'll take simply, making money is more important. To do that, then you generate consumerism, right? Because then by generating consumerism, you have a volume of movement of money. Because only if there's movement of money can you make a lot of money. Right? If there's not a movement of money, then how much you have, you make it gradually. You know what I'm saying? You have some wealth or something else, and maybe with time you get a little bit more land or a little more cows or a little bit more something, and you get it. But if there's big movement of money, you can catch into that, and if you're smart, you can collect more. Like that. So that's also a religion. So the point is when they say religion's the opiate of the people, then you simply ask them, define religion. And then you'll probably find that, their intellectualism kind of like starts to fall apart. Because these things are just easy things to say. It creates conversation, it gets bile moving, it gives them some, purpose in life, some identity. But their life is meaningless. Therefore, as soon as you go define that, well, you know. No, I don't know. That's why I ask, right? I mean, according to English language, if you put a question at the end of the, question mark at the end of a sentence, and when you speak it, you go up, that means you don't know. So therefore, maybe you could explain it. Why? Okay, so then that means blabbing is your opiate. Just talking politics and nonsense and anything that you can find fault in others, that's your opiate. That keeps you, gets you through the day. So what's the difference between you and someone else? Just yours has no meaning, theirs at least they're trying to develop relationship with God and His creation. So therefore, now whose opiate's better? Because no living entity, no human being can function without a religion. So it's either you follow a God-made one or you make one up. As you mentioned, the motorcycle gang, they have their religion. The soccer club, they have their religion. The rock band, they have their religion. So religion, the conditioned living entity can't function without. So it's just a matter of, it means otherwise you create one. Right? What did the Russians say? Following that, then they said they went out there and kept the bread back, so everyone was starving. Said, go pray. They didn't get the bread. Then after they prayed, then say, so where's your bread? No bread. Then they brought in their trucks with all the bread that they were hoarding. And they said, now we give you bread, so we're your gods. So then they were just trying to take over the religion, that's all. So the state became the religion. So it's the same thing. What's the difference? So they didn't get rid of religion, they just became the religion. That's all. So these kind of things are nonsense. Right? Main thing is on this proverb we use on these kind of people is you pick a point where they're weak and don't let them move from the point. Always bring it back. No, but this and that, but still you didn't define what religion is. But this, that, no, but where is the definition of religion? You just keep doing that, and you'll find they squirm and this and that, and then they just break off the conversation, blow up, walk off, something like that. Because they just want to be able to speculate and go here and there. They don't want to be kept to a point, made logical, and so they don't like that. So that's their problem. Catch a Christian. You wouldn't go off here and there, because the point is, as soon as there's some problem, you see there's an obstacle here, they'll bring up the next topic. No, but you don't let it move. You just know, but what about this? He says, thou shalt not kill. No, but that means thou shalt not murder. No, it says here kill, it doesn't say murder. Right? You think that the God didn't know language good enough that he couldn't make the difference between murder and kill? Right? Because murder is a different word than kill, right? Isn't it? So, it is in English, it is in Hebrew, it is in every language of the world. Like that. So why they couldn't make the difference? You're making it that, but it says thou shalt not kill. So why he says don't kill? Why you're killing? Right? You know what I'm saying? You have slaughterhouses. That's not allowed. Even if you're saying that the Jews, they were killing animals, yes, but according to rules, the priests would do it. according to strict rules. So is that what you're doing? You're eating kosher meat? No. So therefore, how can you claim to be Christian? You know, you just take one point and like that, and he says, "That's what I'm killing." What is this? You're not Christian. Christian's supposed to be kind, merciful. That was the whole thing with Shylock, right? Shylock was told to become a Christian because then he would learn compassion and this and that. But, you know, so where's the compassion? You're killing. So you're not Christian. So what are you? Christians don't kill. You're killing. So what are you? You know, in other words, you just catch one thing and just don't let go of it. You know, you follow the process of logic. It hasn't been dealt with, so how can they move on? Emotion, you just move on and go here and there and all that. But you don't allow that. It's just, you just catch it and that. Especially if you're working in intellectual circles, then they must do it this way. Right? You claim to be an academic, so let's have some academics. Where's your logic? It's not logic, it's your feeling and sentiment. That's not very objective, is it? That's pretty subjective. So now I'm supposed to take your subjective opinion, and that's that? Okay, even when you take your subjective opinion, that's your determination. What authority is it based on? Marx is an authority. What social structure has he created that is working today? Where is it? It's not working. Right? China is still communist because they've taken up capitalism. Therefore, they can still run their government that way. But their economics is 100% capitalist. That's why they're making so much money. Right? So it's like, you know, where is this? So they're not real communists. So. And if you're communism, then why is it the person you have this, you have that, why aren't you sharing it? So if you're going to take opium to the people, that means communism means you're not a communist, so why are you saying that? You know, pick and choose just what you like from here and there and then put it together. So then this is your own religion. You know, your religion is picking and choosing from everybody else's and then making your own. But because you made it, therefore that's fine. If someone else makes it, then that's not so good. And if God makes it, definitely we're not interested in that. You say these things and you'll either find that they become very serious or they stop talking to you and they stay out of your way because they figure you're dangerous. You know? Like that. But at least then you don't have to hear nonsense. You know, maybe very quiet at lunchtime because no one will sit with you, but at least then you don't have to listen to their pajama. Okay, so ends here. So I hope. Grantaraj Shrimad Bhagavatam ki, Jai ki, Jai Veta Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Govinda Premanand.
Bhakti Vedya Guru Maharaj ki,
Jai.